This expectation is my first attempt, as I enter the fourth year of my part-time PhD, to try and draw together all the strands that have accumulated thus far, and to tie them together in a coherent way, and offer a core statement of what the research project is about and what its aims are. And at the heart of that is this notion, which I'll try and explain, of personal morphogenesis. And the project as a whole is drawing heavily on Margaret Archer's recent work, which I assume a lot of people in the room will be familiar with, but I'll go over it. I'll go over some core aspects of it briefly, just to be on the safe side. And it begins, or at least this is my interpretation, from an attempt to answer the core sociological question of how does structure and agency relate? And Margaret offers the concept of reflexivity as a means to answer that question. And she contrasts her account, which she terms a three-stage model, to what she termed a two-stage model. In the two-stage model, it's taken that structural or cultural properties objectively shape the situations that agents confront involuntarily, and they exercise powers of constraint and enablement in relation to subjective properties that are imputed to agents and assumed to govern their actions. And exactly what these properties are varies from theory to theory. So, you know, in older critical realism, you have the promotion of vested interests. In rational choice theory, you have instrumental rationality. And in Bourdieusian theory, you have the notion of habitus. And in contrast, the three-stage model argues that, firstly, structural and cultural properties objectively shape the situations that agents confront, and again, possess generative powers of constraint and enablement in relation to, and here comes the divergence, subjects' own constellations of concerns as subjectively defined in relation to the three orders of natural reality. And thirdly, the causes of action are produced through the reflexive deliberations of subjects who subjectively determine their practical projects in relation to their objective circumstances. So the change here is that agency is no longer seen as a black box with the contents imputed by theoretical fiat, but is actually placed at the heart of sociological explanation. So, as Archer puts it, the subjective powers of reflexivity mediate the role that objective structural or cultural powers play in influencing social action, and are thus indispensable to explaining social outcomes. And this final stage of mediation is indispensable because it's what gives us purchase upon exactly what agents do, and it's what allows us to get beyond the level of empirical generalisation about what most people do most of the time. And to delve a bit further into the account, there's the notion of the process of exercising reflexivity and the ends to which it gives rise, which Archer talks about in terms of this movement from concerns to projects to practices. She argues that because of the way we are humanly constituted, because of the way the world is, and because of the necessity of interaction between the two, then inevitably we have concerns in each of the three domains of natural reality: nature, practice, and society. And our concerns, they're sources of meaning and satisfaction, that, you know, they're what gives life the moral texture, the experiential texture it does. And we struggle to act upon and express these concerns, but we do so in situations that are not of our own choosing. And the meaning of those situations is shaped by the concerns we have, both at the level of the generic human concern, so social self-worth, but also the level of elaborated projects, so completing a PhD. And the claim here is that if one has concerns, given human characteristics, given the distinctive properties and powers of the human, we can't help but feel some drive towards trying to actualise those concerns in projects. And furthermore, once we have such projects, we also are driven to try and knit those together into coherent and stable modus vivendi, you know, a way of being in the world, a way of living our lives. And this becomes more complex when you move from philosophical level to the actual social reality which human beings engage with day to day, because we must continually engage and we must continually negotiate between our concerns and our contexts. And so, as Archer terms it, the goal of defining and ordering our concerns through what is effectively a lifelong internal conversation is to arrive, as I've said, at a satisfying and sustainable modus vivendi. But because of the constant continual change and the lack of anything static, really, in the social world, there is a lifelong dialectic between objectivity and subjectivity. Circumstances can change, necessarily or contingently, and so can we, again, necessarily as we move through the life cycle, and contingently because we can reassess our concerns. And so while the three-stage movement is real, in the sense that it's teleological, with generative mechanisms producing the behavioural dispositions that I've talked about, it's an end towards which we move under our own descriptions, and indeed sometimes inarticulately without being able to put words, whatever words, to what we're doing, which is a consequence of the practice of reflexivity. But when represented sequentially, and I'm not for a second saying that Archer is advocating this position, it could be taken to imply some sort of sequentialness. And, you know, in practice, our actual practice of reflexivity over time is messy and particularistic because, as I've discussed, circumstances can change and we change with the ensuing need for the re-evaluation of our concerns, recommittal to projects. And as well, reflexivity presupposes self-knowledge and social knowledge to actually form projects that are sustainable, that, you know, we can actualise and continue to commit ourselves to and engage in within the world. We have to actually understand things about the social world. We have to have knowledge about how that world works. And we also have to have self-knowledge, both at the most banal level of needing to understand exactly what our concerns are. And, you know, contrary to a lot of philosophy after the linguistic turn, you know, the notion here is that our concerns are not exhausted by our capacity to express them linguistically. And there is a constant process, and the work of Charles Taylor is very instructive here, of the drive to try and articulate and re-articulate our understanding of what matters to us, and how through that process of re-articulation, our understanding actually shifts, it becomes more refined. What is the good for us cannot be separated from our capacity to articulate what the good is. And particularly in the case of social knowledge, but also in a more indirect way for self-knowledge, it's a scarce resource. It's not distributed equally throughout society. Access to it differs according to various factors, such as gender, education, age, income, race, occupation. And furthermore, the descriptions under which we deliberate, as well as the concepts entailed and presupposed by our social and self-knowledge, are not static. These too change as we move through the social world. And again, the normative pressures we are socially, culturally subject to, as well as the relation pressures towards reflexive resolution they entail, because we find ourselves, to use Dave Aldavas's term, subject to the demands of competing and often contradictory norm circles, means that we have to think these things through and decide for ourselves, you know, what norms we're going to adhere to, what norms we're going to endorse and enforce ourselves. And these too shift as we make our way through the world. The point of that I'm trying to get across is the sheer emergent complexity which becomes obvious when you see the life course in these terms. And without being polemical, as someone who, you know, has formerly been very interested in these methods and has tried to use them in another research project, it's a kind of emergent complexity which, if you adopt a life history or narrative approach, is pretty likely to be obscured, although, you know, to what degree is another question. And so, given this emergent complexity, the question becomes, how do we unpack it? How do we make sense of it? And this is where I want to introduce another concept, which I'm taking from Derek Lader. He didn't coin the term, but I think he offers a quite particular realist interpretation of it, which I'm starting from, but I'm also going to diverge from a little bit. And this is the notion of psychobiography, which he terms the linked series of evolutionary transitions, which unfold at various significant junctures in the lives of individuals. And this concept, as he puts it, aims to tie together both the subjective and objective facts of an individual's experience. So by focusing on the common features of the social... And he argues that by focusing on the common features of the social context of careers, sociologists have actually neglected the psychological dimensions and individual life careers, with an ensuing overemphasis on the socially constructed nature of the self as it unfolds over time. And he suggests that by identifying psychobiographies as units of analysis, we are concentrating on the intersection or join between two fundamental features of the human social world, and that there is a general need for sociological conceptions of the self to take account of the way in which individual psychology and personality factors interact with the changing personal and social circumstances of the life career as they unfold over time and affect self-identity. However, whereas later sees psychobiography as a unit of analysis, I'm suggesting that it be seen as something real in its own right, as natural emergent phenomena, which arises from the individual's reflexive practice over time. Because the path we negotiate, and in a sense, the path we negotiate through the world, the elaboration of personhood subject to the antecedent constraints and enablements of our nature, which ensues from the manifold deliberations conducted en route, the internal conversations we have as we negotiate the social world, the choices we make, and the consequences for that world and for ourselves which flow from those choices. And so psychobiography, in the sense, should not be taken as the brute fact of the continuity of self, or the, you know, merely the temporal fact of existence. It's an emergent which is at any particular point in time shaped by the relations between antecedent, structural, cultural, and personal factors. So my argument here is that psychobiography, is an actual thing, rather than, say, an aggregate. And it's the temporally unfolding configurative relations between such factors, rather than just their simple presence in an individual's history, which generates the specificity of their particular psychobiography. And as such, you know, it's a diachronic concept. Unpacking it in the context of empirical research, therefore, necessitates isolating synchronic conjunctions of relevant factors. And obviously relevance is something that's defined by the inquiry in question, which, prima facie at least, seem to have conditioned the circumstances faced by the subject in ways that have subsequently led to personal elaboration. And to try and expand on what that elaboration is, I want to talk about two other concepts, which are those of morphostasis and morphogenesis, which figure prominently in Archer's work, and the themselves of a genesis, which goes back to systems theory. And so, in the context of psychobiography, the morphostatic elements are those personal factors, the sociocultural, cultural, systemic, and structural factors, which facilitate the reproduction of intra-personal structures, so habitual phenomena, emotional phenomena, cognitive phenomena, as well as the relations which obtain between them. And conversely, morphogenetic factors are those which lead to the transformation of intrapersonal structures, with, as a corollary of that, ensuing consequences for our path through the world. I think, although that's a claim I'm less sure about than I was when I wrote this. And so over any period of time, the problem is that countless cycles of both personal morphostasis and personal morphogenesis are empirically superimposed within a subject's psychobiography. And again, the emergent complexity we saw in the abstract, when you actually think about this in terms of a particular individual psychobiography, and as abstract as this presentation as a whole might seem thus far, I am thinking about these issues in terms of empirical data. The problem becomes even greater, in this context of empirical data. And so I'm advocating that the way to handle this complexity is to trace conjunctions of factors. So we start from those factors which a subject themselves deems to be pertinent, or perhaps those which, from the account they've given, seem pertinent. And we try and trace the factors that relate to those, so that it's not a case of one-to-one, but a case of multiple connections that coalesce to engender morphostasis of the person or morphogenesis of the person. And the fieldwork within and through which I'm thinking about these issues involved three in-depth interviews per year with undergraduate students at a UK university. It was about all aspects of their lives, and they took place over their first 2 years at university. And the case study I'm going to talk about, and if it wasn't for time constraints, I would like to include more empirical case studies, is a student from an Eastern European country called Dasha and her first year at university. And early on in the interviews, it was obvious the extent to which her continued contact with her boyfriend and her friends, who had not moved to the UK, the importance that had for her day-to-day life. And so she talked to her boyfriend most evenings on Skype, and she'd regularly talk to her friends nearly daily on Facebook and Messenger and email, and would regularly, although less frequently than her boyfriend, talk to them on Skype. And it's through these continued practices, and in terms of this notion of tracing, I think it's important to recognise the conjunction of factors for the boyfriend and the friends, which lead them to perpetuate this communicative practice in relation to Dasha. And in terms of her life in the UK, it allowed the continuation of what I term mediated continuity, which for those familiar with it, I effectively mean what Archer calls contextual continuity. The sharing of a similar mental topography or in its mediated form, an everyday level, simply communicating regularly enough, so quantitatively, but also in such a way qualitatively, that both parties retain some ongoing sense of what is going on in the other's lives. And not just brutally descriptive, but, what matters to them, what their concerns are, what the issues they're facing are. And although this is different from contextual continuity of a kind that's actually arising from geopresence, I think it is still very significant. And it's because of this that Dasha sustained her pre-university relational configuration at a distance, this tight relational network that was deeply meaningful to her and to all parties concerned. Although, obviously, at times she bemoaned the relative inadequacy of talking on Skype versus talking face-to-face, and, still missed her boyfriend and her friends. In a very important way, the relationships did not change very much, despite her being in another country. And this is what I took to be one very significant aspect of her life, a morphostatic conjunction of factors. And in contrast to this, something that I can personally relate to, and I'm sure people who've been in the situation can, she was in Hall's residence and she really did not enjoy it. It was not a very nice place. And the people in there, also, at least from her point of view, were not very nice. So objectively, the facilities were very poor, it was crowded, and it was not good. I need to be more articulate than that. But it was also the case that the norms of day-to-day behaviour that she encountered from her hallmates were really not those that she herself had previously, endorsed and perhaps enforced in a prior co-residence. As she puts it, it's really hard. I'm still going through this because a lot of things still bug me. And I think it's... Today I was thinking that I have to get through this. I mean, to learn how to cope with other people, just to let it go. Just to tell them to to respect me. Or just to don't mind seeing other people's bad habits. So that's the biggest problem that I have here. And I think it's interesting she says bad habits. Because although I couch this in the language of norms and norm circles, you could easily see it in terms of habitual behavioural dispositions and the evaluative judgmental categories that are tied into them. And so there's a potentially morphogenetic disjuncture here between what she habitually expects of her flatmates and their actual behaviour. So left on its own to play itself out, this could either lead her to start to change her expectations, because stuck in this situation, she could, start to recognise that her hallmates, who she felt very culturally isolated from and saw as a relatively homogenous group, mostly British, mostly a couple of years younger than her, and she could adapt her habitual expectations to their actual behaviour. Or alternatively, she could move from merely endorsing an alternative set of norms about how people should live together in that situation to actually actively try and enforce it. So, on a day-to-day situational level, her living conditions in the halls of residence provoked self-questioning, that it provoked an issue for lack of a better term, a personal issue that, at varying points, as she recounted it to me, dominated her internal conversation. Because it's something that she faced day in, day out. And that she couldn't help but try and think of some way of resolving it. Be that to change how she behaved to them. Be that to change herself, her own expectations, or try and escape from the situation. But the fact that she retained this relational network in spite of the distance with her boyfriend and her friends, and also, I guess, the fact that Warwick has a term structure, which means that people are only living together in halls for 10 weeks at a time, and then they usually go home. So, you know, there's almost a bit of an escape valve on tensions that are mounting. But I think primarily because most nights she would be talking to the people close to her and complaining about her hallmates and being told by them, you know, they're being unreasonable, you know, they shouldn't be behaving like this, but what are you going to do? You know, being told that, well, you may feel isolated there, but you still have us. And this conjunction between the morphostatic presence of her mediated presence of her boyfriend and her friends in her life, and the potentially morphogenetic presence of this culturally divergent group in her halls of residence, actually, over time, just left the situation without resolution. And, you know, she did not actually change her real her expectations about how people should live, or alternatively, you know, did not herself actually go off on one. Probably not the right term to use in an academic presentation, at the people in the halls of residence. And so, because of these, you have the empirical superimposition of a set of morphostatic factors, a set of morphogenetic factors, and the morphostatic factors went out. And then by term three, she says that, well, now we have this policy of strict quiet and stuff like that, because it's like the term revision and stuff like that. I don't know. There are less people because there were some Erasmus students, which weren't really annoying, but still the number is not so big now. I don't know. It just feels better this term. And due to, again, a whole series of contingent features, which, when you trace out the connections, relate to all the social domains, really. The issue, again, to use that slightly vague term, started to subside in term three, while the morphostatic presence of her mediated continuity of boyfriend and friends at home continued. And so this potential issue of learning to live with people who weren't her family, adapting her expectations, adapting her behaviour to those who might have divergent expectation and behaviour, didn't actually lead to any personal elaboration over her first year at university, at least in this one specific area of her life, because this is a specific area. And again, the complexity of psychobiographical unfolding comes to the fore. She didn't actually change very much over the course of her year. And yet the following year, when she was living in a house with two people, one friend, one acquaintance, and her boyfriend who had moved to the UK, these day-to-day relational difficulties re-emerged in a way which caused prolonged personal problems for her, which by the time of the last interview were just about seeming to be resolved. And so this notion of personal morphogenesis, when I use it, I'm referring to the intersecting factors across multiple domains, which converge to create issues which demand personal resolution. And the behavioural orientation that people have towards these issues varies. And it varies as well, you know, across life sectors, at least sometimes. So, for instance, someone might engage with issues very differently at work to how they do in their home life. And similarly, the underlying tendencies in how the issue is subsequently framed in their internal conversations and their dialogues with external others also varies. So in this way, I'm arguing that the antecedent personal characteristics stand as a context of action within which personal morphogenesis occurs. So when this morphogenetic process starts to emerge, when an issue becomes live, it's not just factors external to the subject which they have to engage with and perhaps negotiate, There are also, you know, the personal characteristics are a crucial factor in shaping the process, and because is there nature at that point in time which acts to constrain and enable the ensuing process of personal change? And so attempts to resolve the issue, as I spoke about Dasha, can take place over long tracts of time. While it is live, it's a recurrent topic of internal conversation for the subject. Although, obviously, you can have multiple live issues at the same time. And it's important to point out as well, and this is something that became much more clear to me as the empirical research progressed, is that the issues can sometimes be framed in ways which are only partially explicit. So, for instance, the subject might be preoccupied with emotional consequences of it, while the issue itself is something that eludes their discursive awareness. And another thing I became very interested in as the fieldwork progressed was the sources of guidance that people turn to while trying to resolve such issues. Some people try and work on themselves, as it were, and there's one participant in the research and the role that bodybuilding played in helping him settle into life at university, I found very interesting. That didn't have time or space to include in this. Others turn to relationships of various of a whole range of kinds. Other people look to the cultural system. They look to ideas and the way in which the internet radically transforms access to the cultural system, albeit in ways that are not always entirely positive, is something that I found to be quite true over the course of the research. And this didn't seem relevant to the group in question, but you know, some people might look to transform their structural position as a way of resolving certain issues. And the personal resolution of an issue, and resolution shouldn't be taken to imply necessarily a subjectively satisfactory outcome, is something which involves a transformation of intrapersonal structures, sometimes in ways which are hugely significant, but more often not. And these then stand as antecedent conditions for subsequent cycles of personal morphogenesis. And it's at this stage that I'm trying to, as I said at the start, trying to draw these strands together and actually state what the aims of the project are. And there's five of them. The first is to try and develop a practical analytical methodology for life course or biographical research. So both an explanatory framework for understanding biographical trajectory, this concept of psychobiography, but also a practical method for data analysis and interviewing. So this practice of tracing out cross-domain configurations and morphogenetic causes. And also the exploration of the first-person experience of their resolution. Secondly, I want it to be a contribution to the ontology of the person, and there's an initial account, which I'm somewhat bogged down in at the moment, engaging with a range of debates, for instance, about reflexivity and habitus, about neurophysiology and the human. And I want to try and refine this initial account in an iterative dialogue with the empirical data via the sorts of identifiable and clearly delineable episodes in the lives of the participants, such as the one I talked about with Dasha. And to do this, utilising the method of social ontology, which Dave Aldabas has recently advocated. Thirdly, I want to try and generate a typology, and an open-ended typology, rather than some final ontological statement, of the different modalities through which changes at the personal, socio-cultural, cultural, systemic, and structural levels can generate morphogenesis at the level of the individual subject. So the kinds of relations which can obtain between these more kinds of morphogenetic factors and the sorts of intrapersonal structures that I've talked about, and furthermore, the second-order interactions which can obtain between them. And through doing this, I want to try and find an alternative to the individualization literature, which is where I started with my PhD, is the topic of the first chapter, and is also in part what led me into sociology in the first place as an MA philosophy student. Because I've been fascinated by the way in which this literature, the concepts from this literature are used within a range of sociological subdisciplines. The ones I'm most familiar with are youth studies and sexualities, as a way of trying to people draw on them as a way of trying to contextualise the findings of small-scale qualitative research. And through the approach I'm advocating and the apparatus of the conceptual apparatus that I'm trying to generate through it, I want to offer something which would hopefully be able to provide the same sort of overarching macro context. But unlike the individualisation literature, which tends just to amalgamate the small-scale qualitative research with Beckbauer and Giddens talking about late modernity and risk and reflexive biographies, I'm hoping that this typology of modalities and the methodology of tracing morphogenetic and morphostatic connections from the micro level can actually have some explanatory significance for the particular research itself. So rather than just talking in generalities, it could actually be part of the analytical process for the qualitative research and also raise questions which might be useful as part of that research. And it's on this basis that I also would want the PhD to be the thesis to be a contribution to literature on sociocultural change itself. So particularly in terms of late modernity and its moral existential impact on the lives of young people, because as I said, this is as a master's student what I first began reading sociologically, and it fascinated me but frustrated me, and in a way, my entire research project is an attempt to elaborate upon what frustrated me, but also what fascinated me about these authors. Thanks very much.